really want to discourage gaming the system, where a defendant just comes out and says, you know, I want to test. Just, I want to see what the results would be.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears an Alaska DNA case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 2nd of March. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, Kim Elton says goodbye to the state Senate to take a job with the Obama administration.
I don't know that I could have done this job without the wonderful people in Juneau.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're an artist who expresses yourself creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance, you may be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant. You can learn more online at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments this morning in an Alaska case. An Anchorage man convicted of a brutal rape and beating 16 years ago wants modern DNA testing done on the evidence. But the state is refusing him the test, saying there's no reason to believe he's innocent. The question now before the Supreme Court is whether convicted criminals have a constitutional right to sophisticated DNA testing. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
William Osborne was a Fort Richardson soldier when he was arrested for the rape and kidnapping of an Anchorage prostitute in 1993. The victim was brutalized, shot, and buried in the snow, left for dead. She later identified her attackers, and an Anchorage jury convicted Osborne after his accomplice pleaded guilty. At the time, Osborne's lawyer did not ask for the most sophisticated type of DNA testing then available, saying it may have hurt his case, not helped it. Instead, the DNA testing done on a condom found at the scene narrowed down the pool to about 15% of all African Americans. Now Osborne wants a new, more precise type of testing, which could narrow down identity to one in trillions. He's offered to pay for the test, but the state of Alaska won't grant him access. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled last year that he's entitled to it, and now the decision is up to the nation's highest court. Osborne's side was argued by Peter Neufeld, a co-founder of the Innocence Project, which represents the wrongly convicted. He says, why not do the test?
God forbid we really want to keep somebody who's factually innocent in prison for any amount of time. And if we now have this truth machine, it would be a terrible thing not to allow anybody with the test could be conclusive evidence of innocence to not have access to it.
Some of the justices seemed to agree. Justice David Souter said looking at the evidence won't automatically overturn the conviction. It will just give more information. Neufeld says Alaska is one of only six states where criminals are not guaranteed a right to go back and do modern DNA testing. And Neufeld says even in those other five states, there are at least some instances where testing was granted, leading to exonerations.
Alaska stands alone in the whole country in its stubbornness not to allow DNA testing. And hopefully the court will say that it's simply irrational given the power of DNA.
Alaska Assistant Attorney General Ken Rosenstein says the state is willing to allow post-conviction DNA testing when it's warranted. He argued that it should be up to the state, not the federal government.
The case is really about who gets to decide the terms under which, in the process by which a convicted defendant can seek post-conviction access to evidence.
Rosenstein said Osborne hasn't met the state's requirements for testing, starting with the fact that he's never declared his innocence under oath. In fact, he admitted to the attack at a parole hearing.
Mr. Osborne is just not the type of candidate that we think these procedures, especially an over-the-counter demand like he has made, he's not a particularly meritorious candidate.
Chief Justice John Roberts and others suggested testing be limited to those who say they are innocent and are willing to stake their claim on the threat of perjury. Rosenstein says if a convict doesn't assert his innocence, then it's just a fishing expedition.
We really want to discourage gaming the system. Where, you know, a defendant just comes out and says, you know, I want to test. I want to see what the results would be. I mean, if It's a relatively simple and basic act that if you're innocent, you should unhesitatingly say that.
Justices Anthony Kennedy and Samuel Alito expressed concerns that if everyone is allowed DNA testing post-conviction, then a defendant could skip testing during trial, taking his chances, and then demand it afterward just to see if it pans out. But Osborne's lawyer, Peter Neufeld, says the Alaska guidelines are tough to follow because his client needs evidence to show he deserves a retest.
In Alaska's statute, it's not enough to just say, I'm innocent, to get the test. You have to say, I'm innocent, and provide clear and convincing evidence when you file that piece of paper for post-conviction relief. And he can't do it because he doesn't have the tests, and that's the catch-22.
The federal government backed up Alaska's position, and the new deputy solicitor general argued there is no constitutional right to DNA testing and said deciding otherwise would nullify states' rules already in place. He also said it could open floodgates. The justices are expected to issue a decision in the spring or early summer. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
State Senator Kim Elton has resigned to become the Director of Alaska Affairs for the Department of Interior in Washington, D.C. Elton's resignation was effective at 5 p.m. He left the state capitol immediately after making the announcement on the Senate floor. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports.
In an emotional speech, Kim Elton said it was difficult to leave the Senate, where he has represented Juneau for three terms, as well as two terms in the House before that. Rumors that Elton was in line for a position in the Obama administration have swirled through the Capitol for a couple of weeks. Elton says he did not seek the job, but was asked if he would consider working in the new administration. He says he interviewed with the Interior Department in mid-January. On Friday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar offered him the position as Director of Alaska Affairs. For much of his time in the Senate, Elton was in the Democratic minority. But when the Senate organized as a bipartisan coalition, Democrats joined Republicans in the majority, giving Elton a position on Senate Finance Committee.
I've learned an awful lot in the last 3 years, especially serving in a majority that has had people from both parties. And the lesson that I've learned and that I think is going to be one of the most important ones that I take back with me is that when you sit down and you work together, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, You tend to work in the middle, and that's where most of the people we work for want us to be.
In his floor speech, the senator thanked his colleagues, staff, and wife Mary Lou Elton. Calling the Senate the best job he's ever had, he also thanked his Juneau constituents.
I don't know that I could have done this job without the wonderful people in Juneau. The people who agree with me and people who don't agree with me, they have almost without exception been so courteous and so understanding. We all know that when we push a red button or a green button, that not everybody is going to agree with us. And the people that have hired me understand that, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Governor Palin has 30 days to nominate a replacement for Elton. The Greater Juneau Democratic District is accepting applications through Wednesday from Juneau Democrats who are interested in the appointment. Juneau Democrats actually placed advertisements in the Juneau Empire before he was offered the job. Legislative Counsel Jack Chenoweth says there is no requirement the governor choose from the list the Democrats may put forward.
She has 30 days to find someone who is 25 years of age, 3 years a resident of the state, 1 year a resident of the Senate district, District B, and someone who is a Democrat that the remaining members of the Democratic Party in the Senate will agree to.
Juneau Representative and House Minority Leader Beth Curtula has been suggested as a likely successor.
It would truly be my great honor to be able to serve Juneau in that capacity, and I have very respectfully asked to be able to do that.
Elton starts as Interior Director for Alaska Affairs on March 16th. The Interior Department manages more than 200 million acres of land in Alaska and has oversight of the Bureaus of Indian Affairs, Land Management, Fish and Wildlife, and National Park Service. Elton will be working on various Alaska issues, such as the Natural Gas Pipeline, Offshore Drilling, and Endangered Species Act. He says he discussed the job with Alaska Senators Murkowski and Begich and Congressman Don Young. All three sent congratulatory messages on Monday and say the Interior Department position is crucial for Alaska. Another state senator, Republican Drew Pierce, resigned from the Senate in 2001 to take the same position in the Bush administration. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a climate action plan for Alaska's coastal communities.
We're hoping that this really becomes a momentum where coastal communities who depend on a healthy ecosystem come together as one voice urging immediate action.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
A large share of Alaska's federal stimulus funds will go to education. Most of the money will be used for Title I programs that help economically disadvantaged students and for special ed. The state's largest school district, Anchorage, is expecting an infusion of nearly $26 million in both of those areas over the next 2 years. Carol Como is superintendent of the Anchorage Public Schools. She told APRN's Lori Townsend she has lots of ideas for putting the funding to good use.
One of the things that the board and I have been talking about is trying to institute more preschools in those Title I schools, because in the long run, I think that's the best measure there is to increasing graduation rates in the long haul and reducing dropout rates. So that's one of the things we've talked about. The special education, you can redirect up to 50% of that to other title programs. So we think we can redirect some of that money to help us with our huge and growing immigrant population, and also with our training of our staff and how we really can raise student achievement.
And how about some examples, specific examples of where this money might make the biggest difference?
Well, I do believe in the Title I schools for sure, because we have a great need for more training and to really manage the large and growing numbers of intensive needs students and special education students. Each school that's a Title I school would define what their greatest needs are, looking at all their data, their test scores, their discipline records there. Some schools might use some of it to pay teachers to do home visits. There's a lot of things we can do to really bring families more into the picture, as well as training our staff.
Republicans have criticized the large amount of money from the stimulus that's going to education, saying it doesn't create jobs, and that's what's needed now for the economy. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I do believe it creates jobs because, for instance, if we start some preschool programs, you can bet that's going to be more teachers hired. That will be teacher assistants hired. In our Title II, III, IV, V, and VII programs that we could use some of that funding for, we have not been able to hire as many support staff as the students need. And same thing in special education. And with additional funding, we'll be able to hire more assistants and teachers to support those people.
Governor Palin and others have expressed concern that this is a short-term funding stream, that it could be used to start programs that will then have to either be shut down or that the state will have to pick up the funding for. Do you think that will be the case?
Well, it may be in some of the case, but I will tell you, I'd rather have the funding for 2 years to see exactly what kind of an impact that amount of funding could make. And if it is making the impact that I think it will, then we're going to have some serious discussions in our district about what do we give up in order to maintain these programs, or if we decide that the two-year funding isn't worth keeping that program, then we will have learned from the 2 years. So I see it as an opportunity. I think it's an opportunity to really look at school reform in a lot of ways, a lot of new ideas that we could do and try and see what works.
You're also involved with the Council of Great City Schools. What are you hearing nationally from your colleagues about their either enthusiasm or concern about the funding, education funding in the stimulus bill?
Well, I've been on two conference calls, one with Secretary Duncan and a number of urban superintendents. All of us, without fail, said that we want to see the money coming. Many, many states are having to cut education terribly. We are not in that situation at this point. So we're one of the few lucky states, but without fail, they all feel, as I do, that we need to take this money and use it as it was intended. And it really is something that we strongly support, the large amount of funding going to education, because we think if we invest in our young people and so that they get a good education, they're going to be far more competitive in the worldwide job market.
Carol Como is superintendent of Anchorage Public Schools. A conference that wrapped up in Homer last week drafted an agreement addressing climate change and ocean acidification. The gathering included representatives of coastal communities from across the state who will bring the agreement back to their elected officials in the areas and urge them to adopt it. KBBI's Casey Kelly reports.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council put the event together with the intention of drafting the agreement in order to urge swift action on climate change and other issues at the state and federal level. AMCC's Homer Outreach Coordinator Alan Parks says at the end of the day, everyone walked away excited about the final product.
It was a true consensus process. It wasn't a partial consensus. It was, everybody coming together, agreeing on, who we were sending this document to, what the content of it is, what the principles are, what the actions needed to address the issue are. So it was a consensus.
The next step is for those who drafted the agreement to bring it back to their local communities, which includes Petersburg, Sitka, Gustavus, Dillingham, Kodiak, and Homer. Parks says hopefully the city councils and assemblies in those areas will sign on to the agreement, urging state and federal leaders to take on climate change issues.
We're going to seek other communities to sign on to it, and we're hoping that this really becomes a momentum where coastal communities who depend on a healthy ecosystem come together as one voice urging immediate action.
Kenai Peninsula Borough Assemblyman Bill Smith from Homer plans to take the agreement to his fellow assembly members. He doesn't want to predict whether or not the entire assembly will get behind it, but he says the issues raised in the document can't be ignored either.
In recent years, it's become a real focus when we start looking at ocean acidification, which certainly here in Homer we have, all of our commercial fishing efforts are affected by the health of the ocean. In our other coastal communities, we have, we have commercial fishing, sports fishing, we have subsistence activities, and they're all impacted by the health of the ocean, which is in turn being impacted by global climate change.
Dillingham City Councilman Bob Hemshute says he'll not only bring the agreement to other members of the City Council, but also to tribal governments in the Bristol Bay region. Hemshute says once people understand the effect climate change is having on the planet, he thinks they'll support the agreement. He compares it to educating people about the threats posed by the proposed pebble mine.
I don't know myself yet on an educational level where to quantify it as compared to pebble. But I think it's something that needs to be brought up in our community, and I think it's something that will be received and hopefully acted on.
Park says the Alaska Marine Conservation Council will continue to be involved, even though it's now up to the conference attendees to push for more action on the agreement. He says AMCC will provide education and outreach to coastal communities in support of their efforts. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
A new study by the National Audubon Society shows birds are wintering farther north, including some species in Alaska. The study's authors say the shift is likely due to global warming. They note that from 1966 to 2005, the 40 years the study covers, the average January temperature in the lower 48 rose about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Audubon's president, John Flicker, says the research was compiled from data drawn from the annual Christmas bird counts.
The likely impacts of climate change can be seen right now in the birds that Americans see or don't see right outside their doors and at their bird feeders. These birds are like our canaries in the coal mine. They're telling us that we'd better do something to curb global warming and to protect habitat and to do it now.
The Audubon study mentions 19 species in Alaska and says all of them shifted farther north and increased significantly in population. The director of bird conservation for Audubon Alaska, Matt Kirchhoff, says all the species studied throughout the country moved an average of 35 miles north, with some shifting hundreds of miles.
What the study has shown is that across North America, most of the birds are wintering at higher latitudes than they did 40 years ago. And so we've seen this northward movement of the so-called center of abundance for many of these different species. Over half of the species that they're recording are moving north.
Kirchhoff says of the more than 300 species counted, 79 also showed a shift to the south. The birds moving north in Alaska include the Bohemian waxwing, pine grosbeak, and dark-eyed junco. Kirchhoff says there's an additional issue unique to Alaska. The birds can't simply fly farther north to find colder weather.
The problem in Alaska is that the birds don't have any further north to go, so we're seeing an influx of birds from the south. But our concerns are with birds that are breeding or wintering in Alaska. They don't have, as the habitat changes, they don't have any further north to go.
Kirchhoff says Audubon is concerned that as the climate changes, the tundra will gradually change too. He fears birds that go north in search of tundra will find it increasingly replaced by shrub and tree growth. Kirchhoff says warming will also affect offshore species, such as the ivory gull, that feed near ice.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Alaska State Elks Association, committed to eliminating the use and abuse of illegal drugs in support of a drug-free environment. Information at alaskastateelks.org.
Nearly half the members of the legislature are headed to Washington, D.C. this week for the annual conference of the Energy Council. That's the group of governmental representatives from state governments and Canadian provinces, and occasionally from other countries, who share an interest in energy issues. The group of 26 Alaska legislatures attending the council is larger than usual, but House Speaker Mike Chenault says having that many members in the nation's capital could be a good thing, although they will not be carrying a unified message to Congress or to the council.
There certainly is a lot of reasons for us to send people back to D.C. Every year we go back on Energy Council. We are an energy state. And I think it's important not only with the stimulus package, but certainly with the hopes of a gas pipeline. We have a new administration. We have, still ANWR out on the table and a number of other issues out there. I think it is important that we send people back.
With so many members gone, the legislature is effectively closing for several days. No House or Senate committees will meet on Thursday or Friday, and only a few Senate subcommittees are now scheduled for Monday and Tuesday of next week, although that could change by this weekend. The Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, is bringing bomb-sniffing dogs to southeast Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Keith Whitehead of TSA's Juneau office says canine teams are part of an effort to beef up security in the region.
I don't know if you guys remember a couple of years ago when the Ketchikan Airport got shut down for an entire day because of a bomb threat. Unfortunately, there weren't any canine assets anywhere close by. We have received approval to receive 3 canine teams that will station in Juneau so we can provide much more immediate response throughout southeast Alaska.
The teams will be in action for the summer season. Whitehead says the dogs may play a role in cruise ship security as well as airport operations. TSA also plans to increase its expertise in Ketchikan.
We're expecting to bring in a new bomb appraisal officer who's a specialist in explosives, gone to a specialized training school, either with the FBI or the Navy or two of the top programs, to help us not only test our people, but to also have that resource available for the communities as well in order to help ensure that, get an expert in here that really knows what they're dealing with in these types of things.
The federal agency employs about 150 people in the region year-round, about 40 of them in Ketchikan. Whitehead says another 20 or so staffers work during the tourist season regionally. He says the annual TSA payroll in Southeast is about $8 million. About a quarter of that goes to staff in Ketchikan. TSA has been involved in two controversial Alaska issues of late. One would make baggage handling more difficult in Ketchikan. Whitehead says his agency is working with airport staff to resolve the matter. The other is new requirements for small air carriers that some say will raise fares or drive companies out of business. Whitehead says the changes will not affect small air carriers in Ketchikan or the rest of Southeast.
It's not the float planes running around here. It is Air Aviation has operations up in Kodiak. We've got, they actually got jet service up there out of Kodiak, and they aren't screening their passengers. And then they're flying into Anchorage and then changing planes out of there.
Whitehead spoke at Wednesday's Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce meeting. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Ketchikan.
another poor return forecast for king salmon on Kodiak's Karluk River has prompted the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to restrict the sport fishing season even before it starts. Len Schwartz is the sport fish area biologist for Fish and Game in Kodiak.
The trend has been really down, and we're kind of anticipating another poor run this year. So we're going to do just what we did last year. We're going to start the season off with a non-retention fishery. So if you catch any kings, you have to immediately let them go, not even take them out of the water.
Last year's Fish and Game wound up closing the river to king fishing. And if this year's run is no better, Schwartz says he'll be forced to do it again. He says king salmon runs have been declining everywhere, but the Karluk run has shrunk to a tenth of what it once was.
So it is pretty dramatic, and we're not restricted just to the Karluk River. We've also seen a decline in the returns in the Iyakulik and across the Shelikof over there in Chignik. Their kings are also starting to dip down, too.
He says Fish and Game only counts the returning salmon and not the smolt heading out to sea, so it's impossible to tell whether the decline is happening in freshwater or salt. The king salmon that return to the Karluk system are generally 5 or 6 years old, and Schwartz says the poor runs are now into their second generation.
The brood for this 2009, when you look back at 2004, for example, we had 7,000 kings spawn that year, so that was a good escapement. So, you know, we had the potential to generate some good returns, but we're just seeing some really poor returns come back from those escapements.
And it's not just king salmon that are declining. The red salmon run on the Karluk fuels a big commercial and sport fishery, and until last year, Schwartz says the runs were strong.
And then last year, again, it was just kind of a real big shock. We actually closed the sport fishery for sockeye as well as kings because the sockeye run didn't meet the minimum escapement goal. So that was a brand new phenomenon. It hadn't happened for years and years and years.
Schwartz says the sockeye sports fishery will start with the normal bag limit this year, though Fish and Game will monitor. The emergency order for Karluk drainage kings is in effect from June 1st through July 25th, unless the run improves. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Casey Kelly in Homer, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.